Moonchild by Aleister Crowley. Chapter 1. A Chinese God. London, in England, the capital city of the British Empire, is situated upon the banks of the Thames. It is not likely that these facts were unfamiliar to James Abbott McNeill Whistler, a Scottish gentleman born in America and resident in Paris, but it is certain that he did not appreciate them, for he settled quietly down to discover a fact which no one had previously observed, namely, that it was very beautiful at night. The man was steeped in Highland fantasy, and he revealed London as wrapped in a soft haze of mystic beauty, a fairy tale of delicacy and wistfulness. It is here that the fates showed partiality, for London should rather have been painted by Goya. The city is monstrous and misshapen. Its mystery is not a brooding, but a conspiracy. And these truths are evident above all to one who recognizes that London's heart is Charing Cross. For the old cross, which is even technically the center of the city, is so in sober moral geography. The Strand roars toward Fleet Street, and so to Ludgate Hill, crowned by St. Paul's Cathedral. Whitehall sweeps down to Westminster Abbey and the Houses of Parliament. Trafalgar Square, which guards it at a third angle, saves it to some extent from the modern banalities of Piccadilly and Pall Mall. Mere Georgian sham stucco, not even rivals to the historic grandeur of the great religious monuments. For Trafalgar really did make history. But it is to be observed that Nelson, on his monument, is careful to turn his gaze upon the Thames. For here is the true life of the city, the aorta of that great heart of which London and Westminster are the ventricles. Charing Cross Station, moreover, is the only true metropolitan terminus. Euston, St. Pancras, and King's Cross merely convey one to the provinces, even perhaps to savage Scotland, as nude and barren today as in the time of Dr. Johnson. Victoria and Paddington seem to serve the vices of Brighton and Bournemouth in winter, Maidenhead and Henley in summer. Liverpool Street and French Church Street are mere suburban sewers. Waterloo is the funeral antechamber to Woking. Great Central is a notion imported, name and all, from Broadway, by an enterprising king of railway Barnum named Yerkes. Nobody ever goes there, except to golf at Sandy Lodge. If there are any other terminals in London, I forget them, clear proof of their insignificance. But Charing Cross dates from before the Norman conquest. Here Caesar scorned the advances of Boadiza, who had come to the station to meet him, and here St. Augustine uttered his famous mot, Non Angli, sed Anguli. Stay. There is no need to exaggerate. Honestly, Charing Cross is the true link with Europe and therefore with history. It understands its dignity and its destiny. The station officials never forget the story of King Alfred and the cakes, and are too wrapped in the cares of who knows what to pay any attention to the necessities of would-be travelers. The speed of the trains is adjusted to that of the Roman legions, 3 miles per hour. And they are always late in honor of the immortal Fabius. Qui cunt tando restituit rem. This terminus is swathed in immemorial gloom. It was in one of the waiting rooms that James Thompson conceived the idea for his City of Dreadful Night. But it is still the heart of London, throbbing with a clear longing towards Paris. A man who goes to Paris from Victoria will never reach Paris. You will find only the city of the demi-mondaine and the tourist. It was not by appreciation of these facts, it was not even by instinct, that Lavinia King chose to arrive at Charing Cross. She was, in her peculiar esoteric style, the most famous dancer in the world, and she was about to poise upon one exquisite toe in London, execute one bleath, pirouette, and leap to Petersburg. No. Her reason for alighting at Charing Cross was utterly unconnected with any of the facts thereto discussed. Had you asked her, she would have replied with her unusual smile, insured for $75,000, that it was convenient for the Savoy Hotel. So on that October night, when London almost shouted its pity and terror at the poet, She only opened the windows of her suite because it was unseasonably hot. It was nothing to her that they gave on to the historic Temple Gardens. Nothing that London's favorite bridge for suicides loomed dark beside the lighted span of the railway. She was merely bored with her friend and constant companion, Lisa Lujufria, who had been celebrating her birthday for 23 hours without cessation as Big Ben tolled 11. Lisa was having her fortune told for the 8th time that day by a lady so stout and so iron-clad in corset that any reliable authority on high explosives might have been tempted to hurl her into Temple Gardens, lest the worst thing came unto him, and so intoxicated that she was certainly worth her weight in grape juice to any temperance lecturer. The name of this lady was Amy Bruff, and she told the cards with resistless reiteration. "You'll certainly have 13 birthday presents," she said for the 113th time, "and that means a death in the family. Then there's a letter about a journey, and there's something about a dark man connected with a large building. He is very tall, and I think there's a journey coming to you. Something about a letter. Yes. 9 and 3's 12 and 1's 13. You'll certainly have 13 presents. I've only had 12. Complained Lisa, who was tired, bored, and peevish. "Oh, forget it," snapped Lavinia King from the window. "You've got an hour to go, anyhow." "I see something about a large building," insisted Amy Bruff. "I think it means hasty news." "That's extraordinary," cried Lisa, suddenly awake. "That's what Bunyip said my dream last night meant. That's absolutely wonderful. And to think there are people who don't believe in clairvoyance." From the depths of an armchair came a sigh of infinite sadness.
"Give me a peach."
Harsh and hollow, the voice issued cavernously from a lantern-jawed American with blue cheeks. He was incongruously clad in a Greek dress with sandals. It is difficult to find a philosophical reason for disliking the combination of this costume with a pronounced Chicago accent. But one does. He was Lavinia's brother. He wore the costume as an advertisement. It was part of the family game. As he himself would explain in confidence, it made people think he was a fool, which enabled him to pick their pockets while they were preoccupied with this amiable delusion. "Who said peaches?" observed a second sleeper, a young Jewish artist of uncannily clever powers of observation. Lavinia King went from the window to the table. Four enormous silver bowls occupied it. Three contained the finest flowers to be bought in London, the tribute of the natives to her talent. The fourth was brimmed with peaches at 4 shillings a peach. She threw one apiece to her brother and the knight of the silver point. "I can't make out this jack of clubs," went on Amy Bruff. "It's something about a large building." Blaustein, the artist, buried his face and his heavy curved spectacles in his peach. "Yes, dearie," went on Amy with a hiccup. "There's a journey about a letter. And 9 and 1's 10 and 3's 13. You'll get another present, dearie, as sure as I'm sitting here." "I really will?" asked Lisa, yawning. "If I never take my hands off this table again." "Oh, cut it out," cried Lavinia. "I'm going to bed. If you go to bed on my birthday, I'll never speak to you again."
"Oh, can't we do something?" said Blaustein, who never did anything anyhow but draw.
"Sing something,"
said Lavinia's brother, throwing away the peach stone and settling himself again to sleep. Big Ben struck the half hour. Big Ben is far too big to take any notice of anything terrestrial. A change of dynasty is nothing in his young life.
"Come in, for the land's sake," cried Lavinia King. Her quick ear had caught a light knock upon the door.
She had hoped for something exciting, but it was only her private, tame pianist, a cadaverous individual with the manners of an undertaker gone mad, the morals of a stool pigeon, and imagining himself a bishop.
"I had to wish you many happy returns," he said to Lisa when he had greeted the company in general, "and I wanted to introduce my friend, Cyril Gray."
Everyone was amazed. They only then perceived that a second man had entered the room without being heard or seen. This individual was tall and thin, almost as the pianist.
but he had the peculiar quality of failing to attract attention. When they saw him, he acted in the most conventional way possible, a smile and a bow and a formal handshake and the right word of greeting. But the moment that introductions were over, he apparently vanished. The conversation became general. Amy Bruff went to sleep. Blaustein took his leave. Arnold King followed. The pianist rose for the same purpose and looked around for his friend. Only then did anyone observe that he was seated on the floor with crossed legs, perfectly indifferent to the company. The effect of the discovery was hypnotic. From being nothing in the room, he became everything. Even Lavinia King, who had wearied of the world at 30 and was now 43, saw that here was something new to her. She looked at that impassive face. The jaw was square, the planes of the face curiously flat. The mouth was small, a poppy petal of vermilion, intensely sensuous. The nose was small and rounded, but fine, and the life of the face seemed concentrated in the nostrils. The eyes were tiny and oblique, with strange brows of defiance. A small tuft of irrepressible hair upon the forehead started up like a lone pine tree on the slope of a mountain. For with this exception, the man was entirely bald, or rather, clean-shaven, for the scalp was gray. The skull was extraordinarily narrow and long. Again, she looked at the eyes. They were parallel, focused on infinity. The pupils were pinpoints. It was clear to her that he saw nothing in the room. Her dancer's vanity came to her rescue. She moved in front of the still figure and made a mock obeisance. She might have done the same to a stone image. To her astonishment, she found the hand of Lisa on her shoulder. A look, half shocked, half pious, was in her friend's eyes. She found herself rudely pushed aside. Turning, she saw Lisa squatting on the floor opposite the visitor, with her eyes fixed upon his. He remained apparently quite unconscious of what was going on. Lavinia King was flooded with a sudden, causeless anger. She plucked her pianist by the arm and drew him to the window seat. Rumor accused Lavinia of too close intimacy with the musician, and rumor does not always lie. She took advantage of the situation to caress him. Monet Knott, for that was his name, took her action as a matter of course. Her passion satisfied alike his purse and his vanity. And being without temperament, he was the curate type of ladies' man, he suited the dancer, who would have found a more masterful lover in her way. This creature could not even excite the jealousy of the wealthy automobile manufacturer who financed her. But this night, she could not concentrate her thoughts upon him. They wandered continually to the man on the floor. "Who is he?" she whispered, rather fiercely. "What did you say his name was?"
"Cyril Gray," answered Monet Knott indifferently. "He's probably the greatest man in England in his art."
"And what's his art?"
"Nobody knows," was the surprising reply. "He won't show anything. He's the one big mystery of London."
"I never heard such nonsense," retorted the dancer angrily. "Anyhow, I'm from Missouri."
The pianist stared.
"I mean, you've got to show me," she explained. "He looks to me like one big bluff."
Monet Knott shrugged his shoulders. He did not care to pursue that topic. Suddenly, Big Ben struck midnight. It woke the room to normality. Cyril Gray unwound himself like a snake after 6 months' sleep. But in a moment, he was a normal, suave gentleman, all smiles and bows again. He thanked Miss King for a very pleasant evening. He only tore himself away from a consideration of the lateness of the hour.
"Do come again," said Lavinia sarcastically. "One doesn't often enjoy so delightful a conversation." "My birthday's over," moaned Lisa from the floor, "and I haven't got my 13th present."
Amy Bruff half woke up.
"It's something to do with a large building," she began and broke off suddenly, abashed, she knew not why. "I'm always in at tea time," said Lisa suddenly to Cyril.
He simpered over her hand before they realized that he had bowed himself out of the room. The three women looked at each other. Suddenly, Lavinia King began to laugh. It was a harsh, unnatural performance, and for some reason her friend took it amiss.
She went tempestuously into her bedroom and banged the door behind her. Lavinia, almost equally cross, went into the opposite room and called her maid. In half an hour, she was asleep. In the morning, she went in to see her friend. She found her lying on the bed, still dressed, her eyes red and haggard. She had not slept all night. Amy Bruff, on the contrary, was still asleep in the armchair. When she was roused, she only muttered, "Something about a journey in a letter." Then she suddenly shook herself and went off without a word to her place of business in Bond Street, for she was the representative of one of the great Paris dressmaking houses. Lavinia King never knew how it was managed. She never realized even that it had been managed. But that afternoon she found herself inextricably bound to her motor millionaire. So Lisa was alone in the apartment. She sat upon the couch with great eyes, black and lively, staring into eternity. Her black hair coiled upon her head, plate over plate. Her dark skin glowed. Her full mouth moved continually. She was not surprised when the door opened without a warning. Cyril Gray closed it behind him with swift stealth. She was fascinated. She could not rise to greet him. He came over to her, caught her throat in both his hands, bent back her head, and taking her lips in his teeth, bit them almost through. It was a single deliberate act. Instantly, he released her, sat down upon the couch by her, and made some trivial remark about the weather. She gazed at him in horror and amazement. He took no notice. He poured out a flood of small talk, theaters, politics, literature, the latest news of art. Ultimately, she recovered herself enough to order tea when the maid knocked. After tea, another ordeal of small talk, she had made up her mind. Or, more accurately, she had become conscious of herself. She knew that she belonged to this man, body and soul. Every trace of shame departed. It was burnt out by the fire that consumed her. She gave him 1,000 opportunities. She fought to turn his words to serious things. He baffled her with his shallow smile and ready tongue that twisted all topics to triviality. By 6 o'clock, she was morally on her knees before him. She was imploring him to stay to dinner with her. He refused. He was engaged to dine with a Miss Badger in Cheney Walk. Possibly he might telephone later if he got away early. She begged him to excuse himself. He answered, serious for the first time, that he never broke his word. At last he rose to go. She clung to him. He pretended mere embarrassment. She became a tigress. He pretended innocence, with that silly, shallow smile. He looked at his watch. Suddenly his manner changed like a flash.
"I'll telephone later, if I can,"
he said with a sort of silky ferocity and flung her from him violently onto the sofa. He was gone. She lay upon the cushions and sobbed her heart out. The whole evening was a nightmare for her, and also for Lavinia King. The pianist, who had looked in with the idea of dinner, was thrown out with objurgations. Why had he brought that cat, that brute, that fool? Amy Bruff was caught by her fat wrists and sat down to the cards. But the first time that she said, "Large building," was bundled bodily out of the apartment. Finally, Lavinia was astounded to have Lisa tell her that she would not come to see her dance, her only appearance that season in London. It was incredible. But when she had gone, thoroughly huffed, Lisa threw on her wraps to follow her, then changed her mind before she had gone halfway down the corridor. Her evening was a tempest of indecisions. When Big Ben sounded 11, she was lying on the floor, collapsed. A moment later, the telephone rang. It was Cyril Gray. Of course. Of course. How could it be any other?
"When are you likely to be in?"
he was asking. She could imagine the faint, hateful smile, as if she had known it all her life. "Never," she answered. "I'm going to Paris the first train tomorrow."
"Then I'd better come up now."
The voice was nonchalant as death, or she would have hung up the receiver.
"You can't come now. I'm undressed."
"Then when may I come?"
It was terrible, this antinomy of persistence with a stifled yawn. Her soul failed her.
"When you will," she murmured.
The receiver dropped from her hand, but she caught one word, the word,
"taxi."
In the morning, she awoke almost a corpse. He had come, and he had gone. He had not spoken a single word, not even given a token that he would come again. She told her maid to pack for Paris, but she could not go. Instead, she fell ill. Hysteria became neurasthenia. Yet she knew that a single word would cure her. But no word came. Incidentally, she heard that Cyril Gray was playing golf at Hoylake. She had a mad impulse to go to find him, another to kill herself. But Lavinia King, perceiving after many days that something was wrong, after many days, for her thoughts rarely strayed beyond the contemplation of her own talents and amusements, carried her off to Paris. She needed her, anyhow, to play hostess. But 3 days after their arrival, Lisa received a postcard. It bore nothing but an address and a question mark. No signature. She had never seen the handwriting, but she knew. She snatched up her hat and her furs and ran downstairs. Her car was at the door. In 10 minutes, she was knocking at the door of Cyril's studio. He opened. His arms were ready to receive her, but she was on the floor, kissing his feet.
"My Chinese god, my Chinese god," she cried.
"May I be permitted,"
observed Cyril earnestly,
"to present my friend and master, Mr. Simon If."
Lisa looked up. She was in the presence of a man very old but very alert and active. She scrambled to her feet in confusion.
"I am not really the master," said the old man cordially, "for our host is a Chinese god, as it appears. I am merely a student of Chinese philosophy."
Chapter 2. A Philosophical Disquisition Upon the Nature of the Soul.
There is little difference, barring our Occidental subtlety, between Chinese philosophy and English,
observed Cyril Gray.
The Chinese bury a man alive in an antheap. The English introduce him to a woman.
Lisa Le Jufria was startled into normality by the words. They were not spoken in jest, and she began to take stock of her surroundings. Cyril Gray himself was radically changed. In fashionable London, he had worn a claret-colored suit, an enormous gray butterfly tie hiding a soft silk collar. In Bohemian Paris, his costume was diabolically clerical in its formality. A frock coat, tightly buttoned to the body, fell to the knees. Its cut was as severe as it was distinguished. The trousers were of sober gray. A big black four-in-hand tie was fastened about a tall, uncompromising collar by a cabochon sapphire so dark as to be hardly noticeable. A rimless monocle was fixed in his right eye. His manner had changed to parallel his dress. The supercilious air was gone. The smile was gone. He might have been a diplomatist at the crisis of an empire. He looked even more like a duelist. The studio in which she stood was situated on the Boulevard Arago, below the Sante prison. It was reached from the road through an archway, which opened upon an oblong patch of garden. Across this, a row of studios nestled, and behind these again were other gardens, one to each studio, whose gates gave onto a tiny pathway. It was not only private, it was rural. One might have been 10 miles from the city limits. The studio itself was severely elegant, simplex munditis. Its walls were concealed by dull tapestries. In the center of the room stood a square-carved ebony table, matched by a sideboard in the west and a writing desk in the east. 4 chairs with high Gothic backs stood about the table. In the north was a divan, covered with the pelt of a polar bear. The floor was also furred, but with black bears from the Himalayas. On the table stood a Burmese dragon of dark green bronze. The smoke of incense issued from its mouth. But Simon If was the strangest object in that strange room. She had heard of him, of course. He was known for his writings on mysticism and had long borne the reputation of a crank. But in the last few years he had chosen to use his abilities in ways intelligible to the average man. It was he who had saved Professor Briggs, and incidentally, England, with that genius, had been accused of and condemned to death for murder, but was too preoccupied with the theory of his new flying machine to notice that his fellows were about to hang him. and it was he who had solved a dozen other mysteries of crime, with apparently no other resource than pure capacity to analyze the minds of men. People had consequently begun to revise their opinions of him. They even began to read his books. But the man himself remained unspeakably mysterious. He had a habit of disappearing for long periods, and it was rumored that he had the secret of the elixir of life. For although he was known to be over 80 years of age, his brightness and activity would have done credit to a man of 40, and the vitality of his whole being, the fire of his eyes, the quick conciseness of his mind bore witness to an interior energy almost more than human. He was a small man dressed carelessly in a blue serge suit with a narrow dark red tie. His iron-gray hair was curly and irrepressible. His complexion, although wrinkled, was clear and healthy. His small mouth was a moving wreath of smiles, and his whole being radiated an intense and contagious happiness. His greeting to Lisa had been more than cordial. At Cyril's remark, he took her friendly by the arm and sat her down on the divan.
"I'm sure you smoke," he said. "Never mind, Cyril. Try one of these. They come from the Khedive's own man."
He extracted an immense cigar case from his pocket. One side was full of long partagas, the other of cigarettes.
"These are musk-scented, the dark ones. The yellowish kind are ambergris, and the thin white ones are scented with attar of roses."
Lisa hesitated. Then she chose the ambergris. The old man laughed happily.
"Just the right choice. The middle way. Now I know we are going to be friends."
He lit her cigarette and his own cigar.
"I know what is in your mind, my dear young lady. You are thinking that two's company and three's none, and I agree. But we are going to put that right by asking Brother Cyril to study his Kabbalah for a little. For before leaving him in the Antheap, he has really a shocking turn of mind. I want a little chat with you. You see, you are one of us now, my dear."
"I don't understand,"
uttered the girl, rather angrily, as Cyril obediently went to his desk, pulled a large square volume out of it, and became immediately engrossed.
"Brother Cyril has told me of your three interviews with him, and I am perfectly prepared to give a description of your mind. You are in rude health, and yet you are hysterical. You are fascinated and subdued by all things weird and unusual, though to the world you hold yourself so high, proud, and passionate. You need love, it is true. So much you know yourself. And you know also that no common love attracts you. You need the sensational, the bizarre, the unique. But perhaps you do not understand what is at the root of that passion. I will tell you. You have an inexpressible hunger of the soul. You despise earth and its delusions, and you aspire unconsciously to a higher life than anything this planet can offer. I will tell you something that may convince you of my right to speak. You were born on October the 11th. So Brother Cyril told me, but he did not tell me the hour. You never told him. It was a little before sunrise."
Lisa was taken aback. The mystic had guessed right.
"The order to which I belong," pursued Simon If, "does not believe anything. It knows, or it doubts, as the case may be. And it seeks ever to increase human knowledge by the method of science, that is to say, by observation and experiment. Therefore, you must not expect me to satisfy your real craving by answering your questions as to the existence of the soul. But I will tell you what I know and can prove. Further, what hypotheses seem worthy of consideration. Lastly, what experiments ought to be tried. For it is in this last matter that you can aid us. And with this in mind, I have come up from San Zandaluz to see you."
Lisa's eyes danced with pleasure.
"Do you know?"
she cried.
"You are the first man that ever understood me."
"Let me see whether I do understand you fully. I know very little of your life. You are half Italian, evidently. The other half, probably Irish."
"Quite right.
You come of peasant stock, but you were brought up in refined surroundings, and your nature developed on the best lines possible without check. You married early."
"Yes, but there was trouble. I divorced my husband and married again 2 years later."
"That was the Marquis," La Jufria?
Yes.
Well then, you left him, although he was a good husband and devoted to you, to throw in your lot with Lavinia King.
I have lived with her for 5 years, almost to a month.
Then why? I used to know her pretty well myself. She was, even in those days, heartless and mercenary. She was a sponger, the worst type of courtesan. And she was an intolerable poseuse. Every word of hers must have disgusted you. Yet you stick to her closer than a brother.
That's all true. But she's a sublime genius, the greatest artist the world has ever seen.
She has a genius, distinguished Simon If. Her dancing is a species of angelic possession, if I may coin a phrase. She comes off the stage from an interpretation of the subtlest and most spiritual music of Chopin or Tchaikovsky, and forthwith proceeds to scold, to wheedle, or to blackmail. Can you explain that reasonably by talking of two sides to her character? It is nonsense to do so. The only analogy is that of a noble thinker and his stupid, dishonest, and immoral secretary. The dictation is taken down correctly and given to the world. The last person to be enlightened by it is the secretary himself. So I take it is the case with all genius. Only in many cases the man is in more or less conscious harmony with his genius and strives eternally to make himself a worthier instrument for his master's touch. The clever man, so-called, the man of talent, shuts out his genius by setting up his conscious will as a positive entity. The true man of genius deliberately subordinates himself, reduces himself to a negative, and allows his genius to play through him as it will. We all know how stupid we are when we try to do things. Seek to make any other muscle work as consistently as your heart does without your silly interference. You cannot keep it up for 48 hours. I forget what the record is, but it's not much over 24. All this, which is truth ascertained and certain, lies at the base of the Taoistic doctrine of non-action. The plan of doing everything by seeming to do nothing. Yield yourself utterly to the will of heaven, and you become the omnipotent instrument of that will. Most systems of mysticism have a similar doctrine. But that it is true in action is only properly expressed by the Chinese. Nothing that any man can do will improve that genius. But the genius needs his mind, and he can broaden that mind, fertilize it with knowledge of all kinds, improve its powers of expression, supply the genius, in short, with an orchestra instead of a tin whistle. All our little great men, our one poem poets, our one-picture painters have merely failed to perfect themselves as instruments. The genius who wrote The Ancient Mariner is no less sublime than he who wrote The Tempest. But Coleridge had some incapacity to catch and express the thought of his genius. Was ever such wooden stuff as his conscious work? While Shakespeare had the knack of acquiring the knowledge necessary to the expression of every conceivable harmony, and his technique was sufficiently fluent to transcribe with ease. Thus we have two equal angels, one with good secretary, the other with a bad one. I think this is the only explanation of genius. In the extreme case of Lavinia King, it stands out as the one thing thinkable. Lisa La Jufria listened with constantly growing surprise and enthusiasm. I don't say, went on the mystic, that the genius and his artist are not inseparably connected. It may be a little more closely than the horse and his rider, but there is at least a distinction to be drawn, and here is a point for you to consider. The genius appears to have all knowledge, all illumination, and to be limited merely by the powers of his medium's mind. Even this is not always a bar. How often do we see a writer gasp at his own work? I never knew that, he cries, amazed, although only a minute previously he has written it down in plain English. In short, the genius appears to be a being of another plane, a soul of light and immortality. I know that much of this may be explained by supposing what I have called the genius to be a bodily substance,
in which the consciousness of the whole race, in his particular time, may become active under certain stimuli. There is much to be said for this view. Language itself confirms it, for the words to know, gnosis, are merely sub-echoes of the first cries implying generation in the physical sense. For the root gan means to know, only in the second place. Its original sense is to beget. Similarly, spirit only means breath. Divine and most other words of identical purport imply no more than shining. So it is one of the limitations of our minds that we are fettered by language to the crude ideas of our savage ancestors. And we ought to be free to investigate whether there may not be something in the evolution of language besides a monkey trick of metaphysical abstractions. Whether, in short, men have not been right to sophisticate primitive ideas. Whether the growth of language is not evidence of a true growth of knowledge. Whether, when all is said and done, there may not be some valid evidence for the existence of a soul.
The soul! Exclaimed Lisa joyfully. Oh, I believe in the soul.
Very improper, rejoined the mystic. Belief is the enemy of knowledge. Skeet tells us that soul probably comes from su, to beget.
I wish you would speak simply to me. You lift me up and throw me down again all the time.
Only because you try to build without foundations. Now I am going to try to show you some good reasons for thinking that the soul exists and is omniscient and immortal, other than that about genius, which we have discussed already. I'm not going to bore you with the arguments of Socrates, for although as a member of the Hemlock Club which he founded, I perhaps ought not to say so. The Phaedo is a tissue of the silliest sophistry. But I am going to tell you one curious fact in medicine. In certain cases of dementia, where the mind has long been gone and where subsequent examination has shown the brain to be definitely degenerated, there sometimes occurs moments of complete lucidity, where the man is in possession of his full powers. If the mind depended absolutely on the physical condition of the brain, this would be difficult to explain. Science, too, is beginning to discover that in the various abnormal circumstances, totally different personalities may chase each other through a single body. Do you know what is the great difficulty with regard to spiritualism? It is that of proving the identity of the dead man. In practice, since we have lost the sense of smell on which dogs, for instance, principally rely, we judge that a man is himself either by anthropometric methods, which have nothing to do with the mind or the personality, or by the sound of the voice, or by the handwriting, or by the contents of the mind. In the case of a dead man, only the last method is available. And here we are tossed on a dilemma. Either the spirit says something which he is known to have known during his life, or something else. In the first case, somebody else must have known it, and may conceivably have informed the medium. In the second case, it is rather disproof than proof of the identity. Various plans have been proposed to avoid this difficulty, notably the device of the sealed letter to be opened a year after death. Any medium divulging the contents before that date receives the felicitations of her critics. So far, no one has succeeded, though success would mean many thousands of pounds in the medium's pocket. But even if it happened, proof of survival would still be lacking. Clairvoyance, telepathy, guesswork, there are plenty of alternative explanations. Then there is the elaborate method of cross-correspondences. I won't bore you with that. Brother Cyril will have plenty of time to talk to you at Naples. Lisa sat up with a shock. Despite her interest in the subject, her brain had tired. The last words galvanized her. I shall explain after lunch, continued the mystic, lighting a third partaga. Meanwhile, I have wandered slightly from the subject, as you were too polite to remark. I was going to show you how a soul with a weak hold on its tenant could be expelled by another. How indeed half a dozen personalities could take turns to live in one body.
That they are real, independent souls is shown by the fact that not only do the contents of the mind differ, which might conceivably be a fake, but their handwritings, their voices, and that in ways which are quite beyond anything we know in the way of conscious simulation, or even possible simulation. These personalities are constant quantities. They depart and return unchanged. It is then sure that they do not exist merely by manifestation. They need no body for existence.
You are coming back to the theory of possession, like the Gadarene swine,
cried Lisa, delighted. She could hardly say why. Cyril Gray interrupted the conversation for the first time. He swung round in his armchair and deliberately cleared his throat while he refixed his eyeglasses.
In these days,
he observed,
when devils enter into swine, they do not rush violently down a steep place. They call themselves moral reformers and vote the prohibition ticket.
He shut up with a snap, swung his chair around again, and returned to the study of his big square book.
I hope you realize, remarked Simon, what you have let yourself in for.
Lisa blushed laughingly.
You have set me at my ease. I should certainly never know how to talk to him.
Always talk, observed Cyril Gray without looking up. Words, words, words. It's an awful thing to be Hamlet when Ophelia takes after Polonius. She wants to know how to talk to me, and I want to teach her to be silent, even as the friend of Catullus turned his uncle into a statue of Harpocrates.
Oh, yes, I know Harpocrates, the Egyptian god of silence,
gushed the Irish-Italian girl. Simon If gave her a significant glance, and she was wise enough to take it.
There are subjects which it is better to drop. You know, Mr. If, said Lisa to lighten the sudden tension, I've been most fearfully interested in all that you have said, and I think I've understood quite a part of it. But I don't see the practical application. Do you want me to get messages from the mighty dead?
Just at present, said the mystic.
I want you to digest what you have heard, and the déjeuner which Brother Cyril is about to offer us. After that, we shall feel better able to cope with the problems of the fourth dimension. Dear me.
And poor little Lisa has to do all that before she learns the reason of your leaving San Zandaluz?
All that, and the whole story of the homunculus. Whatever is that? After lunch.
But as it turned out, it was a very long while before lunch. The bell of the studio rang brusquely. Cyril Gray went to the door, and once again Lisa had the impression of a duelist. No, it was a sentinel that stood there. Her vivid power of visualization put a spear in his hand. It was his own studio, but he announced his visitors as if he had been a butler.
Akbar Pasha and Countess Helena Motich.
Simon F. sprang to the door. It was not his studio, but he welcomed the visitors with both hands outstretched.
Since you have crossed our threshold, he cried, I'm sure you will stay to déjeuner.
The visitors murmured a polite acceptance. Cyril Gray was frowning formidably. It was evident that he knew and detested his guests, that he feared their coming, that he suspected who could say what. He acquiesced instantly in his master's words, yet if silence ever spoke, this was the moment when it beggared curses. He had not given his hand to his guests. Simon If did so, but he did it in such a way that each of them was obliged to take a hand at the same moment as the other. Lisa had risen from the divan. She could see that some intricacy was on foot, but could form no notion of its nature. When the newcomers were seated, Lisa found that she was expected to regale them with the news of Paris. It was rather a relief to her to get away from the mystic's theories. The others left everything to her. She rattled off some details of Lavinia King's latest success, then suddenly noticed that Cyril Gray had laid the table, for his eager, cynical voice broke into the conversation.
I was there,
he said.
I liked the first number. The dying Krampus fantasy in B-flat was extraordinarily realistic. I didn't care so much for the misadventures of a pat of butter sonata. But the Tchaikovsky Symphony was best. That was atmosphere. It put me right back among the old familiar scenes. I thought I was somewhere in the Southeastern Railway waiting for a train.
Lisa flamed indignation.
She's the most wonderful dancer in the world.
Yes, she is that,
said her lover with affected, heavy sadness.
Wonderful, my father used to say, too, that she used even to dance well when she was 40.
The nostrils of La Jufria dilated. She understood that it was a monster that had carried her away, and she made ready for a last battle. But Simon If announced the meal.
Pray you be seated, he said. Unfortunately, today is a fast day with us. We have but some salt fish with our bread and wine.
Lisa wondered what kind of a fast day it might be. It was certainly not Friday. The Pasha made a wry face.
Ah, said If. If he had just remembered it. But we have some caviar.
The Pasha refused coldly.
I do not really want a déjeuner, he said. I only came to ask whether you would care for a séance with the Countess.
Delighted, delighted, cried If.
And again Lisa understood that he was on the alert, that he sensed some deadly yet invisible peril, that he loathed the visitors, and yet would be careful to do everything that they suggested. Already she had a sort of intuition of the nature of the way of the Tao.
Chapter 3. Telekinesis. Being the art of moving objects at a distance. The Countess Motich was far more famous than most prime ministers or imperial chancellors. For to the great bewilderment of many alleged men of science, she had the power of small objects to move without apparent physical contact. Her first experiments had been with a pure blind old person named Udowitz, who was in love with her in his senile way. Few people swallowed the published results of his experiments with her. If convinced, they would have been very much startled. For she was supposed to be able to stop clocks at will, to open and close doors without approaching them, and other feats of the same general type. But she had sobered down since leaving the professor, which she had done just as soon as she had acquired enough money to get married to the man she wanted. Her power had left her instantly, strange to say, and many were the theories propounded connecting these circumstances. But her husband had displeased her, she had flown off in a rage, and her power had returned. But most of her sensational feats were relegated to the bad, mad old days of wild and headstrong youth. At present, she merely undertook to raise light small objects, such as tiny celluloid spheres, from the table without touching them. So Cyril explained when Lisa asked,
"What does she do?"
The Countess was supposed to know no English. She spoke it as well as anyone in the room, of course.
"She moves things," he said. "Manages to get hold of a couple of hairs when we're tired of looking at foolishness for hours together. Twists them in her fingers, and miracle of miracles, the ball rises in the air. This is everywhere considered by all rightly disposed people to be certain proof of the immortality of the soul."
"But doesn't she challenge you, ask you to search her and all that?"
"Oh, yes. You've got the same chance as a deaf man has to detect a mistake in a castle's recital. If she can't get a hair, she'll pull a thread from her silk stockings or her dress. If you get people that are really too clever for her, then the force is very weak this afternoon. Though she keeps you longer than ever in the hope of tiring your attention and perhaps to pay you out for baffling her."
Gray said all this with an air of the most hideous boredom. It was evident that he hated the whole business. He was restless and anxious, too, with another part of his brain. Lisa could see that, but she dared not question him, so she went on the old track.
"Doesn't she get messages from the dead?"
"It's not done much now. It's too easy to fake, and the moneyed fools lost interest as a class. The new game tickles the vanity of some of the sham scientific people like Lombroso. They think they'll make a reputation like Newton out of it. They don't know enough science to criticize the business on sensible lines. Oh, really? I prefer your fat friend with the large building and the letter about a journey
You mean that whole thing is absolute fraud?
Can't say. Hard to prove a negative or to affirm a universal proposition. But the onus of proof is on the spiritualists, and there are only two cases worth considering. Mrs. Piper, who never did anything very striking anyhow, and Eusapia Palladino.
She was exposed in America some time ago, said the girl, but I think it was only in the Hearst newspapers.
Hearst is the American Northcliffe,
explained Cyril for the benefit of the Pasha.
And so is Norcliffe,
he added musingly and unblushingly.
I'm afraid I don't know who Norcliffe is, said Akbar. Norcliffe was Harmsworth.
Cyril's voice was caressing like one soothing a fractious child.
But who was Harmsworth? Asked the Turk.
The young magician, in a hollow tone.
Nobody.
Nobody, cried Akbar.
I don't understand.
Cyril shook his head solemnly and sadly.
There ain't no such person.
Akbar Pasha looked at Gray as if he were a ghost. It was a horrible trick of the boy's. He would invite confidence by a sensible, even possibly a bright remark. Then, in an explanatory way, he would lead his interlocutor with exquisite skill through quaking sands of various forms of insanity, only to drop them at the end into the bog of dementia. The dialogue suddenly realized itself as a nightmare. To Cyril, it was probably the one genuine pleasure of conversation. He went on in a brisk, professional manner with a suave, persuasive smile.
I am trying to affirm the metaphysical dogma enunciated by Schelling in his philosophy of the relative, emphasizing in particular the lemma that the acceptation of the objective as real involves the conception of the individual as a tabula rasa, thus correlating Occidental theories of the absolute with the Buddhist doctrine of Sakyaditi, but confer in rebuttal the Vagasanayi Samhita Upanishad.
He turned brusquely to Lisa with the finality of one who has explained everything to the satisfaction of everybody.
Yes, you do right to speak in defense of Eusapia Palladino. We will investigate her when we reach Naples.
You seem determined that I should go to Naples.
Nothing to do with me. The master's orders. He'll explain by and by. Now let's prove that this lady, whose locks are bushy and black as a raven's, has no hairs concealed upon her person.
I hate when you're cynical and sarcastic.
Love me. Love my dog.
Simon If arrested his attention with an imperious gesture.
Come into the garden, Maud,
said Cyril suddenly.
For the black bat, night hath flown.
He took her by the arm.
Girl,
he said, when they were among the flowers with his long arms about her and a passionate kiss still flaming through every nerve of both their bodies.
I can't explain now, but you're in the most deadly danger from these people, and we simply can't get rid of them. Trust us and wait till they're gone. Keep away from them. Make any excuse you like, if it's necessary. Sham a hysterical attack and bolt if worst comes to the worst. But don't let either of them manage to scratch you. It might be your death.
His evident earnestness did more than convince her. It reassured her on her whole position. She realized that he loved her, that his manner was merely an ornament, an affectation like his shaved head and his strange dress. And her own love for him, freed from all doubt, rushed out, as does the sun from behind the crest of some cold pyramid of rock and ice in mountain lands. When they returned to the studio, they found that the simple preparations for the seance had been completed. The medium was already seated at the table with the two men, one on either side of her. Before her, between her hands, were some small spheres of celluloid, a couple of pencil ends, and various other small objects. These had been examined with the utmost care, as who should examine the tail of a dog to find out whether he would bite. The history of spiritualism is that of blocking up every crack in a room with putty and then leaving the door wide open. It may well be doubted whether even the most tedious writer could describe a seance with success. People generally have an idea that there is something exciting and mysterious about it. In reality, people who boast of their ability to enjoy their third consecutive sleepless night have been known to pray their maker for sudden death at least 2 hours before the occurrence of the first phenomena. To be asked to keep the attention unceasingly on things of not the slightest intrinsic interest or importance is absolutely maddening to anyone above the mental level of a limpet.
"Observe how advantageously we are placed,"
whispered Cyril to Lisa as they took seats on the divan, toward which the table had been drawn.
"For all we know, one or both those men are in collusion with Motich. I'd stake my life Simple Simon isn't, but I wouldn't expect my own twin brother to take my word for it in a matter like this. Then the curtains have been drawn. Why? To help the force along. Yet it is supposed to be kinetic force, and we cannot even imagine how light could interfere with it. Otherwise, it is that the light distresses the medium in her peculiar state, just as the policeman's bullseye distresses the burglar in his peculiar state. Now look here. These arguments about evidential phenomena always resolve themselves into questions of the conditions prevailing at the time. But the gist is that it always turns out that the argument is about conjuring tricks, not about forces at all."
"Won't she mind us talking?"
"Mediums always encourage the sitters to talk. The moment she sees us getting interested in what we are saying, she takes the opportunity to do the dangerous, delicate part of the trick. Then she calls our attention, says we must watch her very carefully to see that the control is good and no cheating possible, because she feels the force coming very strong. Everybody disguises himself as a cat at a mouse hole, which you can keep up after long training for about 3 minutes. Then the attention slackens slightly again, and she pulls off the dear old miracle. Listen."
Simon If was engaged in a violent controversy with the Pasha as to the disposition of the six legs at their end of the table. On the accurate solution of this problem, naughty in more than one sense, depended the question as to whether the medium could have kicked the table and made one of the balls jump. If it were proved that it was impossible, the question would properly arise as to whether a ball had jumped anyhow.
"Isn't it the dullest thing on earth?"
droned Cyril. But even without what he said in the garden, she would have known he was lying. For all his nonchalance, he was watching very acutely. For all his bored, faded voice, she could feel every tone tingling with suppressed excitement. It was certainly not the seance that interested him, but what was it? The medium began to moan. She complained of cold. She began to twist her body about. She dropped her head suddenly on the table in collapse. Nobody took any particular notice. It was all part of the performance. "Give me your hands," she said to Lisa. "I feel you are so sympathetic." As a matter of fact, the girl's natural warmth of heart had stirred her for a moment. She reached her hands out, but Simon If rose from the table and caught them. "You may have a hair or a loose thread," he said sharply. "Lights up, please, Cyril." The old mystic proceeded to make a careful examination of Lisa's hands, but Cyril, watching him, divined an ulterior purpose.
"I say,"
he drawled,
"I'm afraid I was in the garden when you examined the Countess. Oughtn't I to look at her hands if this is to be evidential?"
Simon If's smile showed him that he was on the right track. He took the medium's hands and inspected them minutely. Of course, he found no hairs. He was not looking for them.
"Do you know,"
he said,
"I think we ought to file off these nails. There's such a lot of room for hairs and things."
The Pasha immediately protested.
"I don't think we ought to interfere with the lady's manicuring," he said indignantly. "Surely we can trust our eyes."
Cyril Gray had beaten lynxes in the Open Championship, but he only murmured,
"I'm so sorry, Pasha. I can't trust mine. I'm threatened with tobacco amblyopia."
The imbecility of the remark, as intended, came near to upset the Turk's temper.
"I've always agreed with Berkeley,"
he went on, completely changing the plane of the conversation while maintaining its original subject.
that our eyes bear no witness to anything external. I'm afraid I'm only wasting your time because I don't believe anything I see in any case.
The Turk was intensely irritated at the magician's insolence. Whenever Cyril was among strangers or in any danger, he invariably donned the bomb-proof armor of British aristocracy. He had been on the Titanic a second and a half before she took the last plunge. He had turned to his neighbor and asked casually,
"Do you think there is any danger?"
Half an hour later, he had been dragged into a boat, and on recovering consciousness, took occasion to remark that the last time he had been spilt out of a boat was in Byron's Pool.
Above Cambridge, England, you know.
And proceeded to relate the entire story of his adventure. He passed from one story to another, quite indifferent to the tumult on the boat, and ended by transporting the minds of the others far from the ice of the Atlantic to the sunny joys of the May week at Cambridge. He had got everybody worked up as to what would happen after.
First shot just before Ditton, and missed by half a blade. Jesus washed us off and went away like the devil. Third were coming up like steam, with Hall behind them, and old TJ cursing them to blazes from his gi. It was L for leather all up the Long Beach. Then, thank goodness, Hall jumped third just under the railway bridge. Cox yelled, and there was Jesus.
But they never heard what happened to the first boat of that excellent college, for Gray suddenly fainted, and they found that he was bleeding slowly to death from a deep wound over the heart. This was the man who was frightened out of his life at the possibility of a chance scratch from an exquisitely clean and polished fingernail. The Turk could do nothing but bow.
"Well, if you insist, Mr. Gray, we can only ask the lady."
He did so, and she professed most willing eagerness. The operation was a short one, and the seance recommenced. But in a few minutes, the Countess herself wearied.
"I know I shall get nothing. It's no use. I do wish Baby were here. She could do what you want in a minute."
The Pasha nodded gleefully.
"That's always the way we begin,"
he explained to Simple Simon.
"Now I'll have to hypnotize her, and she'll wake up in her other personality."
"Very, very interesting," agreed Simon. "Curiously enough, we were just discussing double personalities with Madame La Jufria when you honored us with your visit. She has never seen anything of the kind."
"You'll be charmed, Marquis,"
the old Turk assured Lisa.
"It's the most wonderful thing you ever saw."
He began to make passes over the medium's forehead. She made a series of convulsive movements which gradually died away and were succeeded by deep sleep. Cyril took Lisa to one side.
"This is really great magic. This is the old original confidence trick. Pretend to be asleep yourself, so that all the others may go to sleep in reality. It is described at no length whatever by Fraser in his book on sympathetic magic. For that most learned doctor, vir praeclarus et optimus, omits the single essential of his subject. It is not enough to pretend that your wax image is the person you want to bewitch. You must make a real connection. That is the whole art of magic, to be able to do that. And it is the one point that Fraser omits."
The Countess was now heaving horribly and emitting a series of complicated snorts. The Pasha explained that this was normal, that she was waking up into the new personality. Almost before he finished, she had slid off her chair onto the floor, where she uttered an intense and prolonged wail. The men removed the table, that her extrication might become more simple. They found her on her back, smiling and crowing, opening and closing her hands. When she saw the men, she began to cry with fright. Then her first articulation was, "Mum, mum, 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 mum."
"She wants her mother," explained Akbar. "I didn't know a lady was to be present. But as we are so happy, would you mind pretending to be her mother? It would help immensely."
Lisa had quite forgotten Cyril's warning and would have accepted. She was quite willing to enter into the spirit of the performance, whether it was a serious affair, a swindle, or merely an idiotic game. But Simon If interfered.
"Madame is not accustomed to seances," he said.
And Cyril darted a look at her which compelled her obedience, though she had no idea in the world why she should or why she shouldn't do any given thing.
She was like one in a strange country. The only thing to do is to conform to the customs as well as one can, and to trust one's guide. Baby continued to yell. The Pasha, prepared for the event, whipped a bottle of milk out of his pocket, and she began to suck at it contentedly.
"What ridiculous fellows those old alchemists were,"
said Cyril to his beloved.
"How could they have gone on fooling with their Athanors and Cucurbites and Alembics and their Red Dragon and their Caput Mortuum and their Lunar Water? They really had no notion of the dignity of scientific research."
There was no need to press home the bitterness of his speech. Lisa was already conscious of a state of shame at assisting at such degrading imbecilities. Baby relinquished the bottle and began to crawl after one of the celluloid balls, which had rolled off the table when they moved it. She found it in a corner, sat up, and began to play with it. All of a sudden, something happened which shocked Lisa into a disgusted exclamation.
"It is all part of the assumption of babyhood," said Cyril, coldly. "And a bad one. For there is no reason why obsession by a baby's soul or mind should interfere with adult reflexes. The real reason is that this woman comes from the lowest sewers of Budapest. She was a common prostitute at the age of 9, and only took up this game as a better speculation. It is part of her pleasure to abuse the license we allow her by such bestialities, and is a mark of her black envy. She does not understand that her foulness does not so much as soil our shoe leather."
Despite her years of practice in the art of not understanding English, Baby winced momentarily, for her dearest thought was the social prestige which she enjoyed. It was terrible to see that the real thing was not under the slightest illusion. She did not mind 1,000 exposures as a fraud, but she did want to keep up the bluff of being a countess. She was past 35. It was high time she found an old fool to marry her. She had designs on the Pasha. She had agreed to certain proposals in respect of this very seance, with a view to getting him into her power. He was apologizing for her in the conventional way to Simon If. She had no consciousness or memory of this state at all, it appeared.
"She will grow up in a little while. Wait a few moments only."
And so it happened. Soon she was prattling to the Pasha, who thoughtfully produced a doll for her to play with. Finally, she came over on her knees to Lisa and began to cry, and simulate fear and stammer out a confession of some kind. But Lisa did not wait to hear it. She was hot-tempered and constitutionally unable to conceal her feelings beyond a certain point. She dragged her skirts away roughly and went to the other end of the room. The Pasha deprecated the action with oriental aplomb, but the medium had already reached the next and final stage. She went to the Pasha, sat on his knee, and began to make the most violent love to him with wanton kisses and caresses.
"That's the best trick of the lot," explained Cyril. "It goes wonderfully with a great many men. It gets their powers of observation rattled. She can pull off the most obvious miracles and get them to swear that the control was perfect. That's how she fooled Odowitz. He was a very old man, and she proved to him that he was not as old as he thought he was. Great Harry Lauder. Apart from any deception, a man in such circumstances might be willing to swear away his own reputation in order to assure her a career."
"It's rather embarrassing," said the Pasha, "especially to a Mohammedan like myself. But one must endure everything in the cause of science. In a moment now, she'll be ready for the sitting." Indeed, she changed suddenly into personality number 3, a very decorous young French woman named Annette, made to the wife of a Jewish banker. She went with rather stiff decorum to the table. She had to lay breakfast for her mistress, it appeared. But the moment she got there, she began to tremble violently all over, sank into the chair, and resumed the baby personality after a struggle.
"Get away, bad Annette. Naughty, naughty,"
was the burden of her inspiring monologue for a few minutes. Then she suddenly became absorbed in the small objects before her. The Pasha had replaced them, and began to play with them as intently as many children do with toys.
"Now we must have the lights down," said the Pasha.
Cyril complied.
"Light is terribly painful and dangerous to her in this state. Once she lost her reason for a month through someone switching on the current unexpectedly. But we shall make a close examination for all that."
He took a thick silk scarf and bound it over her eyes. Then, with an electric torch, he swept the table. He pulled back her sleeves to the shoulder and fastened them there, and he went over her hands inch by inch, opening the fingers and separating them, searching the nails, proving, in short, to demonstration that there was no deception.
"You see,"
whispered Cyril,
"we're not preparing for a scientific experiment. We're preparing for a conjuring trick. It's the psychology of trickery, not my idea, the master's."
However, the attention of Lisa La Jufria, almost despite herself, was drawn to the restless fingers on the table. They moved and twisted into such uncanny shapes, and there was something in the play of them, their intention towards the frail globe on which they converged, that fascinated her. The medium drew her fingers swiftly away from the ball. At the same instant, it jumped 3 or 4 inches in the air. The Turk purred delight.
"Quite evidential, don't you think, sir?"
he observed to Simon. "Oh, quite," returned the old man, but in a tone that would have made anyone who knew him well continue the conversation with these words. "Evidential of what?" But Akbar was fully satisfied. As a matter of form, he turned the torch on again and made a new examination of the medium's fingers, but no hairs were to be discovered. From this moment, the phenomena became continuous. The articles upon the table hopped, skipped, and danced like autumn leaves in a whirlwind. For 10 minutes this went on, with constantly increasing energy.
"The fun is fast and furious," cried Lisa.
Cyril adjusted his monocle with immense deliberation.
"The epithet of which you appear to be in search," he remarked, "is possibly chronic."
Lisa stared at him while the pencil and ball still pattered on the table like dancing hail.
"Dr. Johnson once remarked that we need not criticize too closely the performance of a whistling cabbage, or whatever it was,"
he explained wearily.
"The wonder being in the fact of the animal being able to do it at all. But I would venture to add that for my part I find wonder amply satisfied by a single exhibition of this kind. To fall into a habit appears to me utterly out of accord with the views of the late John Stuart Mill on liberty."
Lisa always found herself whirled about like a dervish by the strange twists which her lover continued to give to his conversation. Monet Nod had told her in London of his famous faux pas at Cannon Street Station, when the railway official had passed along the train shouting, "All change, all change," only to be publicly embraced by Cyril, who pretended to believe that he was a Buddhist missionary, on the ground that one of the chief doctrines of Buddhism is that change is a principle inherent in all component things. And unless you knew beforehand what Cyril was thinking, his words gave you no clue. You could never tell whether he was serious or joking. He had fashioned his irony in the model of that hard, cold, cruel, smooth, glittering black ice that one finds only in deep gullies of the loftiest mountains. It was said in the clubs that he had found 77 distinct ways of calling a man. To his face, something which only the most brazen fishwives of Billingsgate care to call by its name, without his suspecting anything beyond a well-turned compliment. Fortunately, his lighter side was equally prominent. It was he who had gone into Lincoln Bennett's hatters to His Majesty since helmets ceased to be the wear, had asked with diffidence and embarrassment to see the proprietor on a matter of the utmost importance, and on being deferentially conducted to a private room, he had inquired earnestly,
"Do you sell hats?"
The mystery of the man was an endless inquietude to her. She wished to save herself from loving him, but only because she felt that she could never be sure that she had got him. And that intensified her determination to make him wholly and forever hers. Another story of Monet Knott's had frightened her terribly. He had once put himself to a great deal of trouble to obtain a walking stick to his liking. Ultimately, he had found it with such joy that he had called his friends and neighbors together and bidden them to a lunch at the Carlton. After the meal, he had walked down Pall Mall with two of his guests and discovered that he had forgotten the walking stick.
"Careless of me,"
had been his only remark, and nothing would persuade him to stir a step towards its recovery. She preferred to think on that other side of his character, which she knew from the Titanic episode,
and that other of how his men had feared to follow him across a certain snow slope that hung above a Himalayan precipice. When he had glissaded on his back, head foremost, to within a yard of the brink. The men had followed him then, and she knew that she too would follow him to the end of the world. Lost in these meditations, she hardly noticed that the seance was over. The medium had gradually fallen asleep again, to wake up in her number one personality. But as the others rose from the table, Lisa too rose, more or less automatically with them. The foot of Akbar Pasha caught in the edge of a bearskin, and he stumbled violently. She shot out an arm to save him, but the young magician was quicker. He caught the Turk's shoulder with his left hand and steadied him. At the same moment, she felt his other hand crushing her wrist, and her arm bent back with such suddenness that she wondered that it did not snap. The next moment, she saw that Cyril, with his hand on the Pasha's arm, was begging permission in his silkiest tones to examine a signet ring of very beautiful design.
"Admirable,"
he was saying.
"But isn't the edge too sharp, Pasha? One could cut oneself if one drew one's hand across it sharply, like this."
He made a swift gesture.
"You see?"
he remarked. A stream of blood was already trickling from his hand. The Turk looked at him with sudden black rage, of which she could not guess the cause. Cyril had expressly told her that a scratch might be death, yet he had courted it. And now he stood exchanging commonplaces, with his blood dripping upon the floor. Impulsively, she seized his hand and bound it with her handkerchief. The Countess had wrapped her furs about her, but suddenly she felt faint.
"I can't bear the sight of blood," she said, and collapsed upon the divan.
Simon If appeared at her side with a glass of brandy.
"I feel better now. Do give me my hat, Marquis."
Again, Cyril intervened.
"Over my dead body,"
he cried, feigning to be a jealous lover, and adjusted it with his own hands. Presently, the visitors were at the door. The Turk became voluble over the seance.
"Wonderful,"
he cried.
"One of the most remarkable I was ever present at." "So glad, Pasha,"
replied Gray, with his hand on the door.
"One can't pick a winner every time at this game, can one?"
Lisa La Jufria saw that, somehow, the courteous phrase cut like a whip of whalebone. She turned as the door closed. To her surprise, she saw that Simon If had sunk on the divan and that he was wiping the sweat from his brows. Behind her, her lover took a great breath as one who comes out of a deep water. And then she realized that she had been present not at a seance, but at a battle. She became conscious of the strain upon herself and she broke into a flood of tears. Cyril Gray, with a pale smile, was bending upon her face, kissing away the drops even as they issued. And beneath her, his strong arm bore her whole weight without a tremor.
Chapter 4. Lunch, after all, and a luminous account of the fourth dimension.
"I confess to hunger," said Simon If after a few moments.
Cyril kissed Lisa on the mouth and walked, with his arm still encircling her, to the sideboard.
"You are hostess here now, you know,"
he said, quite simply. All his affectations dropped from him at that moment, and Lisa understood that he was just a simple-minded, brave, and honest man, who, walking in the midst of perils, had devised a formidable armament both for attack and defense. She felt a curious pang of pain simultaneously with a sense of exultation. For she was no longer merely his mistress. He had accepted her as a friend. It was no longer a purely sexual relation, which is always in the nature of a duel. He might cease to love her, in the crude, savage sense, but he would always be a pal, just as if she were a man. And here was the pang. Was he sure to return to the mood that her whole body and soul were, even at that moment, crying out for? The story of his Judgment of Paris, as they called it, came into her mind. Some years before, he had three women in love with him at once. It seemed to each that she was the only one. But they discovered the arrangement. He never took pains to hide such things, and they agreed to confront him. They called at his studio together and told him that he must choose one of them.
He smoked a full pipe before replying, then went to his bedroom and returned with a pair of socks, in need of attention.
Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? Yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. Mend my socks.
He misquoted somewhat blasphemously and threw the socks to the one he really loved. Lisa meant to lay the table in that sense of the word, so to speak. She remembered that the only words spoken by Kundry after her redemption were Gen and Ganon.
Is this your fast?
She cried gaily, discovering the contents of the sideboard. For her gaze fell upon a lobster salad of surprising glory flanked by a bowl of caviar and ice on one side, and one of those foie gras pies, the only kind really worth eating, which you have to cut with a spoon dipped in hot water. On an upper shelf was a pyramid of woodcock prepared for the chafing dish which stood beside them. There was a basket of pears and grapes of more value than a virtuous woman, and we know that her price is above rubies. In the background stood the wines in cohorts. There was a hawk from the cellars of Prince Metternich. There was Burgundy, a Chambertin that could have given body to a ghost and hardly lost its potency. There was a Tokay that really was imperial. There was 1865 brandy made in 1865, which is as rare as radium in pitch blend. Simon If took it upon himself to explain his apparent lack of hospitality toward the visitors.
Akbar Pasha came here for blood, a drop of your blood, my dear. Cyril's and mine are not in his power. You saw how contemptuously the boy played up to his trick, so I persisted in offering him salt and nothing but salt. But why should he want my blood? And why should you give him salt? If he accepts salt, it limits his powers to injure the house where he accepts it, or its inmates, and it exposes him to a terrible riposte. Why he should want your blood, that is another question, and a very serious one. Unfortunately, it implies that he knows who you are and what we purpose for you. If he had it, he could influence you to do his will. We only wish that you should be free to do your own. I won't insult you by telling you that you can go scatheless by the simple process of returning to your ordinary life. I've been watching you, and I know you would despise me for suggesting it. I know that you are ignorant of what may lie before you, but that you judge it to be formidable, and that you embrace the adventure with both hands. I mustn't contradict the famous expert in psychology, she laughed back at him. I ought to deny it indignantly, and I surely am crazy to leap in the dark. Only it isn't dark when love is the lamp. Be careful of love, the old magician warned her. Love is a jack-o'-lantern and hovers over bogs and graves. It is but a luminous bubble of poisonous gas. In our order we say, love is the law, love under will. Will is the iron signal staff. Fix love on that, and you have a lighthouse, and your ship comes safe to harbor.
I may now apologize,
remarked Cyril as they seated themselves at the table,
for leaving you the other night to dine at Miss Badger's. I had given my word to her, and nothing but physical inability would have stopped me from going. I didn't want to go, any more than I wanted to drown myself. And that is a great compliment to you, for she is one of the two nicest women in London. But I would have faced 1,000 deaths to get there.
Is it right to be so stern about a trifle?
Keeping one's word is no trifle. False in one, false in all. Can't you see how simple it makes life for me, never to have to worry about a decision? Always to be able to refer everything to a simple standard, my will? And can't you see how simple it makes life for you, to know that if I once say a thing, I'll do it?
Yes, I do see. But, oh, Cyril, what agony I passed through that evening. That was ignorance, said Simon If, the cause of all suffering. You failed to read him to be assured that just as he was keeping his word to Miss Badger about the dinner, he would keep his to you about the telephone. Now, tell me about the battle. I see that I am the thick of the fight, but I haven't got a ghost of a notion why. I'm sorry, dear child, but this knowledge is unsuited to your exalted grade, he answered playfully.
We must get up to it slowly by telling you exactly what we want to do and why. Then you will see why others should try to thwart us. And I deeply regret to have to inform you that our road lies through somewhat hilly country. You will have to listen to a lecture on the fourth dimension. Whatever in the world is that? I think we had better talk of simpler matters until lunch is over.
They began to discuss their private affairs. There was no reason at all why Lisa should not take up her residence with Cyril from that moment. She had merely to telephone her maid to pack and come along. She offered to do so when Simon If said that he thought they ought to leave Paris without a day's delay. But he said, "I don't think it quite fair on the girl. It's a battle and no call for her to fight. Besides," he turned to Cyril, "she would probably be obsessed in 24 hours.
I shouldn't be surprised to learn that they were after her already. Let's try. Call her, Lisa, and say you'll not be back tonight. Tell her to wait further instructions."
Lisa went to the telephone. Instead of getting her room, she was connected with the manager of the hotel.
"I much regret to have to tell you, madame, that your maid was seized with epileptic fits shortly after you left this morning."
Lisa was too stunned to reply. She dropped the receiver. Cyril crossed to her instantly and told the man that his news had upset madame. She would telephone again later. Lisa repeated what the manager had said.
"I thought as much," said Cyril.
"I didn't," said If, frankly. "And it worries me. I'm not guessing like you are, and it's no credit to guess right, my young friend, but a deceit of the devil like winning at roulette. I'm deducing from what I know, therefore the fact that I'm wrong proves that there is something I don't know, and it worries me. But clearly, we must get into a properly protected area without a moment wasted. That is, you must. I'll watch at the front. There must be somebody big behind that clumsy fool Akbar Pasha."
"Yes, I have been guessing,"
admitted Cyril, with some shame.
"Or perhaps worse, I've let my ego expand and taken the largest possible view of the importance of our project."
"Well, tell me the project," said Lisa. "Can't you see? I can hardly bear this anymore." "You're safe within these walls," said Simon. "Now that there is no enemy within the gates, and tonight we shall take you under guard to a protected area. Tomorrow, the fun will begin in good earnest. Meanwhile, here is the preliminary knowledge with regard to the project. Before you start, you have to take a certain vow, and we cannot allow you to do that in ignorance of all that it implies down to the tiniest iota. I am ready. I'm going to make everything as simple as I possibly can. You'll have a good imagination, and I think you should be able to follow. See here? I take a pencil and a piece of paper. I make a point. It stays there. It doesn't go in any direction. In mathematics, we say it is extended in no dimension. Now I draw a straight line. That line goes in one direction. We say it is extended in one dimension. Now I make another line to cross it at right angles. This is one extension in a second dimension. I see. Add another line would make a third dimension. Don't go too fast. Your third line is of no use. If I want to show you the position of any point on the paper, I can do it by reference to these two lines only. Make a point, and I'll show you." She obeyed. "Now I draw lines from your point to make right angles with my lines. I say your point is so far east of the central point and so far north. You see? I determine the position by only two measurements. But if I made my point right in the air here..." "Exactly. We need a third line, but it must be at right angles to the other two, sticking straight up, as you might say. Then we can measure in three directions and determine the point. It is so far east, so far south, and so high." "Yes. Now we'll go over that again in another way. Here is a point, not long nor broad nor thick. No dimension. Here is a line, long but neither broad nor thick, one dimension. Here is a surface, long and broad but not thick, two dimensions. Here is a solid, long and broad and thick, three dimensions. Now I quite understand. But you said four dimensions. I will say it presently, but just now I'm going to hammer at 2. Observe, I make a triangle. All sides are equal. Now I draw a line through it from one angle to the middle of the other side. I have 2 triangles. They are exactly alike, as you see. Same size, same shape, but they point in opposite directions. Now we will cut them out with scissors. He did so. Slide them about so that one lies exactly to cover the other. She tried and failed, then with a laugh turned one over when it easily fitted. Ah, you cheated, I said. Slide them. I'm sorry. On the contrary, you have acted divinely in the best sense. You took the thing that wouldn't fit out of its world of 2 into the world of 3, put it back, and they all lived happy ever after. The next thing is this. Everything that exists, everything material, has these 3 dimensions. These points and lines and surfaces all have a minute extension in some other dimension, or they would be merely things in our imagination. The surface of water, for instance, is merely the boundary between it and the air. Now I'm going to tell you why some people have thought that another dimension might exist. Those triangles, so like yet so unlike, have analogies in the world of what we call real things. For example, there are 2 kinds of sugar, exactly alike in every way but one. You know how a prism bends a ray of light? Well, if you take a hollow prism and fill it with a solution of one of these kinds of sugar, the ray bends to the right. Use the other kind and it bends to the left. Chemistry is full of these examples. Then we have our hands and feet. However we move about, we can never make them fill exactly the same place. The right hand is always a right hand, however you move it. It only becomes a left hand in a looking glass. So your mirror should in future afford you a superior sort of reflection. It should remind you that there is a looking glass world, if you could only get through. Yes, but we can't get through. Don't let us lose our way. Enough to say that there might be such a world. But we must try to find a reason for thinking that there is one. Now the best reason of all is a very deep one, but try to understand it. Lisa nodded. We know that the planets move at certain rates in certain paths, and we know that the laws which govern them are the same as those which made Newton's apple fall. But Newton couldn't explain the law, and he said that he found himself quite unable to imagine a force acting at a distance, as gravitation, so-called, appears to do. Science was hard put to it, and had finally to invent a substance called the ether, of which there was no evidence, only it must be there. But this ether had so many contradictory and impossible qualities that people began to cast about for some other explanation. And it was found that by supposing an extension of the universe, thin but uniform, in a 4th dimension, that the law would hold good. I know it's hard to grasp the idea, let me put it to you this way. Take this cube. Here is a point, a corner, where the 3 bounding lines join. The point is nothing, yet it is part of the lines. To imagine it at all as a reality, we must say that it has a minute extension in these lines. Now take a line. It has a similar minute uniform extension in the 2 surfaces which it bounds. Take the surface. It is similarly part of the 1 cube. Go one step further. Imagine that the cube is related to some unknown thing as the surface is to the cube. You can't. True. You can't make a definite image of it, but you can form an idea, and if you train yourself to think of this very hard, presently you will get a little closer to it. I'm not going to bother you much longer with this dry theoretical part. I'll only just tell you that a 4th dimension, besides explaining the difficulties of gravitation and some others, gives us an idea of how it is that there is only a definite fixed number of kinds of things from which all others are combined. And now we can get down to business. Brother Cyril, who obliged with the cube, will be so good as to produce a wooden one and a basin of water. Brother Cyril complied. I want you to realize, went on the old man, that all the talk about the progress of science is cheap journalism. Most of the boasted progress is mere commercial adaptation of science.
as who should say that he is experimenting with electricity when he rides in an electric train. 1 year of Edison and Marconi as men of science, neither of them ever discovered a single fact. They merely exploited facts already known. The real men, science, are in absolute agreement that the advance in our knowledge, great as it has been, leaves us as ignorant of ultimate truth and reality as we were 10,000 years ago. The universe guards its secret. Isis can still boast that no man hath lifted her veil. But suppose our trouble were due to the fact that we only received our impressions in disconnected pieces. A very simple thing might seem the maddest jumble. Ready, Cyril?
Quite ready. I A A I U I A R F G L S L. What were we saying?
Lisa laughed rather excitedly. Her vivid mind told her that these instructions were going to take sudden shape. Only your very pretty name, my dear. Now, Cyril, the cone. He took it in his hand and poised it over a bowl of water. We are now going to suppose that this very simple object is going to try its best to explain its nature to the surface of the water, which we will imagine as endowed with powers of observation and reasoning equal to our own. All that the cone can do is to show itself to the water, and it can only impress the water by touching it. So it dips its point thus. The water perceives a point. The cone goes on dipping. The water sees a circle round where the point was. The cone goes on. The circle gets bigger and bigger. Suddenly, as the cone goes completely through, snap. Now, what does the water know? Nothing about any cone. If it got any idea that the various commotions were caused by a single object, which it would only do if it compared them carefully, noted a regularity of rate of increase in the size of the circle, and so on. In other words, used the scientific method, it would not evolve a theory of a cone, for we must remember that any solid body is to it a thing as wildly inconceivable as a fourth dimensional body is to us. The cone would try again. This time we dip it obliquely. The water now perceives a totally different set of phenomena. There are no circles, but ellipses. And dip again, first at this angle, then at that. One way we get curious curves called parabolas. The other way, equally curious curves called hyperbolas. By this time, the water would be nearly out of its mind if it insisted on trying to refer all these absolutely different phenomena to a single cause. It might work out a geometry, our own plane geometry, in fact, and it would perhaps get some extraordinary poetic conception of a creator who manifested in his universe such marvelous and beautiful relations. It would get all sorts of fantastic theories of this creator's power. What it would never get until it produced a James Hinton would be the idea that all this diversity was caused by seeing disjointedly different aspects of one single simple thing. I purposely took the easiest case. Suppose that instead of a cone we used a regular body. The series of impressions would seem to the water like absolute madness. Now slide your imagination up one dimension. Do you not see at once how parallel is our situation to that of the surface of the water? The first impression of the savage about the universe is of a great, mysterious jumble of things which come upon him without rhyme or reason, usually to smite him down. Long later, man developed the idea of connecting phenomena, at least a few at a time. Centuries elapse, he begins to perceive law, at first operating only in a very few matters. More centuries. Some bold thinker invents a single cause for all these diverse effects and calls it God. This hypothesis leads to interminable disputes about the nature of God. In fact, they have never been settled. The problem of the origin of evil alone has quite baffled theology. Science advances, and now we find that all things are subject to law. There is no need of any mysterious creator in the old sense. We look for causes in the same order of nature as the effects they produce. We no longer propitiate ghosts to keep our fires alight.
Now, at last, I and a few others are asking whether the whole universe be not illusion, in exactly the same way as a true surface is an illusion. Perhaps the universe is a four-dimensional object or a collection of objects, quite sane and simple and intelligible, manifesting itself in diversity, regular or irregular, just as the cone did to the water. Of course, I can't grasp all this. I will ask Cyril to tell me again and again until I do. But what is this fourth-dimensional universe? Can't you give me something to cling to? Just so. Here this long lecture links up with that little chat about the soul. Oh. And the double personality, and all the rest of it. It's perfectly simple. I, the fourth-dimensional reality, am going about my business in a perfectly legitimate way. I find myself pushing through to my surface, or let us say, I become conscious of my surface, the material universe, much as the cone did as it went through the water. I make my appearance with a yell. I grow, I die. There are the same phenomena of change which we perceive all around us. My three-dimensional mind thinks all this real, a history, where at most it is a geography, a partial set of infinite aspects. I say infinite, for the cone contains an infinite number of curves. Yet this three-dimensional being is actually a part of me, though such a minute one, and it rather amuses me. Now I have discovered a little bit more of myself to find that mind think that he, or even his yet baser body, is the one and only. I'm understanding you with a part of me that I didn't know was there. That's the way, child. But I'm going on a little. I want you to consider how nicely this explains the psychology of crowds, for example. We may suppose an idea to be a real four-dimensional thing. I, when I know myself more fully, shall probably turn out to be a pretty simple kind of a thing, manifesting in perhaps one person only. But we can imagine abstract individuals who come to the surface in hundreds or thousands of minds at the same time. Liberty, for example, it begins to push through. It is noticed by one or two men only at first. That is like the point of the cone. Then it spreads gradually, or it breaks out suddenly, just as the circle would if, instead of a cone, you dropped a spiked shield upon the water. And that is all the lesson for this afternoon, child. Think it over and see if you have it all clear, and if you can find any other little problems to straighten out. The next lesson will be of a more desperate sort, the kind that leads directly to action. Cyril broke in on the word.
We have a great deal to do, he said sharply. Even before we leave this house, it's pretty dark, and there's a thing in the garden.
Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.